World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, in behalf of Admiral distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you the first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
The B-29s were over Tokyo again today, dropping their huge bomb loads on Jap industry. It was the fourth raid in 10 days. The Japs say about 70 of the big planes made the flight, and they, of course, say damage was light. But a dispatch from Saipan reports there are indications the attack was the most successful so far. Target was the Musashima plant of the Nakajima aircraft factory. In Europe, the Americans have crossed the Tsar River. Further north, they've captured Linnik, and the British have opened an attack on Venlo on the Maas. The Germans say they've evacuated Miskolc before the Russian drive in Hungary, and in Italy, the British 8th Army has cut the main highway between Faenza and Ravenna. Those are the highlights. Now, details. Admiral takes you to CBS London, Bill Downs reporting.
10,000 men from all over Britain paraded the streets of London today to mark the passing of an era in this war against Germany. Representative Home Guard units from every part of the United Kingdom paraded before the King for the last time in an official stand-down ceremony which in effect disbands Britain's civilian army. There were tears in the eyes of many spectators as the long line of very old and very young men swung past. They marched well. Every man was well equipped. It was a far cry from the days of 1940 after Dunkirk, when the government issued a call to arms for all civilians. In that time, these same men, these civilians, took up shotguns and pitchforks and clubs to patrol Britain's vulnerable coastline. No one pretended in those days that the Home Guard could stop a modern Nazi invasion force, but the Home Guard was willing to die in the attempt. Today, they were either too old or too young for the army. There was the smart-stepping old veteran with only one arm. Many elderly men limped, and the beardless youngsters looked embarrassed. Included were a Home Guard contingent of Americans, middle-aged businessmen long resident in England, who for 4 years thought they should fight for the hospitality and freedom that allowed them to work in this country. The significant thing about this farewell ceremony is that while this nation is disbanding its civilian army, the Nazis are just organizing theirs. But as late as last week, when I was on the Geilenkirchen front, I looked at the German civilians who were supposed to make up Hitler's Volkssturm civilian army. They do not have the look of the British Home Guard. It's hard to explain, but in the lean, wrinkled faces of the men who marched for the last time today, there was something far different from what you can see in the face of a German. It's the look of a man who knows he's right, as opposed to the look of a man caught thieving. And this is Bill Downs in London, returning you to Admiral.
And now for a direct report from Supreme Headquarters, Admiral takes you to Paris, Charles Collingwood reporting.
All up and down the Western Front today, the Germans have been counterattacking in an effort to stop the Allied offensive, inching closer and closer to the vital centers of the Ruhr, the Rhineland, and the Saar. When dawn broke this morning, the Germans threw in a counterattack on the First Army front, and from then on, the whole central sector of the First and Ninth Armies was troubled with one counterattack after another. Along the River Roar, north of Lindern, two big counterattacks with infantry plus tanks were broken up by Ninth Army troops with heavy losses to the enemy. And more have been going on this afternoon. On the First Army front, they repulsed two east of Fresnes this morning. One at Lindern around midday and another at 3 o'clock this afternoon at Luschenburg. These constant German counterattacks show with what fear the enemy regards our progress on this central sector. He is certainly no more content with the Third Army's progress into the Saar Valley. We now stand for 13 or 14 miles along the Saar River. Across from Saarlouten, the enemy has blown four bridges, and he has set fire to one Saar village, the first evidence of a German scorched earth policy that we have seen in Germany itself. The Germans were quite willing to burn French villages. Now they have begun to burn their own. Hand in glove with our men on the ground, and the clouds have been so low that it is almost that, have been our fighter bombers. The weather was pretty bad today, but our bomb-carrying fighters broke up one counterattack and did yeoman service, attacking fortifications and gun positions wherever they needed attacking. The ground forces need all the help they can get now, because this is a very tough fight they are in. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
If there were a robber stealing into your home every night to take part of the food from your electric refrigerator, you'd be pretty mad about it, wouldn't you?
I certainly would be mad in these days of rationing and shortages.
Well, that's exactly what's happening every day, unless you own a dual-temp refrigerator. Any electric refrigerator that has the ordinary evaporator, you know, those frost-covered coils, is robbing your foods of their moisture and vital juices. When these coils draw the moisture from your food, it greatly reduces their vitamin content and natural goodness.
But don't all electric refrigerators affect the moisture content of food?
All refrigerators but the Admiral Dual Temp. You see, the Dual Temp has no evaporator, and constant humidity is maintained to keep your foods fresh and crisp the way you like them.
I'm certainly glad to know that. You can quick freeze foods in the Dual Temp, too, can't you?
Yes, the built-in home freezer holds 80 pounds or nearly 2 bushels of frozen foods. You see, the Admiral Dual Temp is really 2 refrigerators in one, each completely insulated from the other, and the temperature is individually controlled. Dual Temp is the successor to the ordinary mechanical refrigerator, and only Admiral can build a Dual Temp. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
This week, German propagandists spoke of a new V-3 designed to bomb New York City. So a CBS reporter thought it a good idea to talk with one of America's buzz bomb experts. For his report, Admiral takes you to Wright Field in Ohio, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
Here at Wright Field in the heart of Ohio, thousands of Air Force men have been hearing a horrifying noise recently that was a source of some annoyance, but nothing more. In Europe, that sound means death and destruction. It's the sound made by the jet-propelled buzz bomb, Hitler's weapon of vengeance. Let's listen to it ourselves for a few seconds. That's the mortar that carries tons of dynamite across the channel. It looks something like a stovepipe, 10 feet long, and from its rear, a sheet of yellow flame licks out for another 10 or 15 feet. It was built here at the Air Technical Service Command from designs based on pieces of the bomb salvaged in London. It was something like men who have never seen a piano designing one from 2 keys and 3 pieces of string. Yet our Air Force was launching buzz bombs within 2 months of the arrival here of a few pieces of junk. Colonel George V. Holloman, chief of the equipment laboratory here at Wright Field, has been working on this buzz bomb, and I'm going to ask him first just what he thinks of the engine the Germans have built to propel buzz bombs. Colonel?
Mr. Slocum, it is one of the simplest engines for the amount of power delivered that I've ever seen in my life.
And the Colonel has seen most of them. What are some of its good points, Colonel?
It's small. It's powerful. It's just a magnificent piece of workmanship.
Do we have any buzz bombs, sir?
Well, we Americans just don't believe in the indiscriminate bombing of civilians.
We know now that Germans can fire these bombs 200 miles or so. Therefore, it seems logical to this civilian mind of mine that they might get a few improvements.
I never yet saw anything that couldn't be improved, Mr. Slocum.
German accuracy with buzz bombs is notoriously bad, Colonel. Do you feel it might, in time, improve?
Improvement is characteristic of Germans, and we can do anything they can do.
That's a sad picture you paint of the future, sir.
Possibly, except for one thing. There will be no large or small nations in the military sense. It should be merely a matter of making and storing propulsion bombs, and maybe no one will dare start a war.
Well, what will this mean to our aerial warfare of the future?
It will mean a lot. Many forward-thinking people are beginning to come around to the opinion that such weapons will replace our present-day tactical warfare, and in the not-too-far-distant future, too.
That means, in your experiments here at Wright Field, you must have one eye cocked on Germany, another on Japan, and a third eye on the future.
Exactly. Wright Field is well known as a place where American air security is safeguarded.
Thank you very much, Colonel Holloman. I think we can all say thanks to you and the tireless technicians out here at Wright Field who spend so many weary, dangerous, and thankless hours designing and testing anything and everything that flies to make sure that American fighting men in the field have just a little the best of it at all times. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In the Mediterranean theater, Italian-based Allied planes have been active again, and our troops continue to edge forward against the Germans. For a summary of developments, Admiral takes you now to CBS Rome, Farnsworth Fowle reporting.
Flying into Yugos on the Adriatic Sea, our plane crossed the snow-capped peaks of the Dinaric Alps, through which the Germans are still retreating north and west. Across this range, we were no longer in the Mediterranean world, on the southern front of the German Reich. We were over the battle area of Germany's eastern front, where the war is being waged principally by the Red Army. Shortly after we landed in Yugoslavia, we caught a first glimpse of the Russian forces that have swept up the Danube this fall, an infantry column on its way to the front. Some were on foot. Others were riding in wagons on top of their kit. The column moved along at a brisk pace in the crisp night air. Some had turned down the earmuffs of their fleece caps. It was still a long way to Germany on foot, but they'd already come even further from their own frontiers. Russian army trucks, many of them American-made, rarely had the canvas covering we're used to. Either they're wide open, or else they're boarded up completely with little stovepipes sticking out the top. They seem to be pretty free and easy about giving rides to the peasants coming in from the countryside. Russian prestige is naturally at its height. It's helped along by such actions as turning over 50,000 tons of wheat to the Yugoslavs, of which 17,000 tons is earmarked for the civilian population of Belgrade. A shipload of coal arrived up the Danube just in time to keep the city's electric power system working. The fodder ration in Belgrade so far is more generous than in Italy. There was plenty of evidence that Tito's regime is not looking exclusively to the east for aid and for an example of political and economic organization. Marshal Tito, the top man in Yugoslavia today, is openly a communist. If the Russians wanted to make a communist state of Yugoslavia today, there is no military force in the country that could stop them. But if you begin to examine Tito's record as leader of the resistance movement, if you talk with the ministers who are drafting the program for the reconstruction of the country, you find that their platform has very little in common with that of Lenin. But if you begin to examine Tito's record as leader of the resistance movement, if you talk with the ministers who are drafting the program for the reconstruction of the country, you find that their platform has very little in common with that of Lenin when the Soviets came into power in Russia. They back private enterprise, both in industry and in peasant ownership of land. They promise fair elections with a secret ballot. The official slogans painted on the walls in the city and out in the country avoid revolutionary utterances and praise the alliance of Yugoslavia with England, America, and the USSR. Everything points to an imminent merger of Tito's committee with the London government in exile. The return of King Peter is much less certain. The chief reason for this has nothing to do with the king personally. The most dramatic political step taken by Marshal Tito has been the bid for the friendship of Bulgaria. In a recent interview, he placed Bulgaria first on the list of neighbors with whom he hoped to have friendly relations. Welcoming the Bulgarian army to fight the Germans on Serbian soil is another bold step in the light of history. The door is obviously open to a federal union of Bulgaria with Yugoslavia. The rival thrones and crowns are a traditional obstacle. So far, there has been no definite commitment, but it is clear that they want to postpone the king's return until the issue has taken shape. This is Farnsworth Fowle in Rome, returning you now to Admiral in New York.
And now to the Pacific, and an interview with a Liberator bomber pilot from Ohio who has made 18 raids on the Bonin Islands. Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor, John Adams reporting.
Air operations continue to make news headlines from the Pacific. Tokyo had been bombed again, for the fourth time in 10 days, by B-29 Super Fortresses of the 21st Bomber Command, flying from bases in the Marianas. A statement issued late last night by Lieutenant General Millard F. Harmon, Deputy Commander of the 20th Air Force, stated briefly that a substantial force of B-29 aircraft based on Saipan today attacked Tokyo industrial targets in a daylight raid. A communique is expected shortly with further details. Throughout the past week, fleet communiques have been loaded with reports of air operations from the Kuriles to the Marshalls. The 7th Air Force has done its share, pounding the Bonin and Volcano Islands, destroying airfields, radio stations, enemy fighters, and harbor installations. Here in the studio today is Lieutenant G.L. Red Outland of Toledo, Ohio, a 7th Air Force Liberator pilot who has made 18 missions over these strategic islands. When did you first see action in the Marianas, Lieutenant Outland?
We went into Saipan on August the 28th, less than 3 months after the Marines and infantry invaded, and there were still plenty of Japs in the bush. 3 days later, we flew our first mission from the Saipan airfield, just a short run up to Pagan, sort of a practice mission. We made 6 bomb runs without meeting opposition.
Well, it was a different story when you started hitting the Bonins, wasn't it, Red?
Sure was. We ran into plenty of flak on our first mission up at Chichijima, but the Japs didn't get around to sending fighters after us until the fourth mission to Iwo Jima. Never could quite understand where they were until then. Since then, we've always met from 4 to 10 fighters over Iwo Jima, even though the airstrips are torn up from our repeated bombings and look impossible for takeoffs or landings.
Well, did the NIP fighters cause you much trouble?
Not very much. They'd come in and toss a couple of phosphorus bombs at us and make a couple of machine gun passes and then pull out. On our 11th mission, though, we picked up a big piece of flak. It went through the bombardier's compartment, just missing my bombardier Lieutenant Dave Smith. He's from Farmington, Connecticut. But it did knock out our whole hydraulic system, and we had no hydraulic control over any of the turrets, the wheels, or flaps. And we lost most of the pressure in the brakes. Returning to Saipan, we were all set to use parachutes to slow up the plane, but the runway was long enough that we didn't have to break them off.
Well, it was sort of scary not to have the turrets working, wasn't it?
Well, neither my co-pilot nor I knew it at the time, but the turret gunners did and started to direct them manually. Lenny Mears, my ball turret gunner from Shorewood, Wisconsin, was so covered with hydraulic fluid that he couldn't see out, but just fired on the directions of the upper turret gunner, George Abernathy, of Carthage, Texas. George kept telling him where the fighters were coming in from, and Lenny would crank away by hand. We managed to get home okay.
Well, do you think this neutralization offensive of the 7th against the Bonins and Volcanoes has been very helpful to the B-29 operations against Japan?
I think so in many ways. It has kept Japs' counterattacks against Saipan to a minimum, as well as fighter opposition that might bother the B-29s in their strikes against Japan. It's also been helpful in doping out weather changes over Tokyo.
Well, did you get a chance to destroy much Jap shipping?
We saw 7 enemy ships one day up at Chichijima as we were making a high-altitude bomb run over the harbor. Smitty was the bombardier for the group, and we got 2 of them. They were both medium-sized freighters and went underwater within 3 minutes. The 7th has made it pretty unprofitable for ships or planes to stop long in the Bonins.
Well, that's true, Red, and you might expand that to include all Central Pacific Islands from Tarawa to Tokyo. You have just heard Lieutenant G.L. Outland, 7th Air Force Liberator pilot and veteran of 18 combat missions against the strategic Bonin and Volcano Islands on the road to Tokyo. This is John Adams speaking from Fleet Headquarters, Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
A few weeks ago, Commander William McGill Collins of Washington shot down 5 Jap fighter planes high above Formosa, and he did it in the length of time it will take me to interview him right now. He's the skipper of one of the most famous fighter squadrons in the Navy, Fighter 8, and he's just brought his men back home after 7.5 months of Pacific fighting. In that time, they fought their way from the Marianas in the east to Palau in the south, Formosa in the west, and within sight of the Jap homeland in the north. They sank more than 43,000 tons of Jap shipping. They shot down 153 enemy planes, caused the Jap untold trouble on the ground, and lost just 6 men of their own. Bill, tell us about your last operation, the one just before you came home.
Well, that covers a lot of territory, Don. We were part of Admiral Mitcher's task force, and in the last operation, we hit Palau first. Then we made the first raid on the Philippines, beginning at Davao in the south and sweeping right up through the central Philippines, including Leyte.
Well, when was that?
The Philippines?
Yeah.
Well, we hit Davao September 9th and wound up in the central Philippines on the 13th.
And then what?
We went back down, took another crack at Palau, and then steamed way up north and raided Manila.
What did you hit up there?
Clark Field.
Oh.
Well, that's the way we felt the night before the raid, when they gave us our target. We didn't sleep much that night, and when we went in at dawn, we didn't carry any bombs on our fighters, because we expected a real scrap. But it turned out to be one of the easiest raids we ever made. There were only four Jap planes in the air, and only one of those was a fighter. We got 25 or 30 more on the ground, all lined up in a nice row, just like ours were at Pearl Harbor.
Accommodating pupils, the Japs. Where did you go from there?
To Nansei-shoto. I think you call it the Ryukyu Islands. That's the southern Japanese group between the Philippines and the Jap mainland.
And what did you find there?
We shot up some airfields and other installations, but our prize catch was a group of four submarines. Lieutenant Commander Scott McCuskey, leader of the squadron's photographic division, found them in a little cove off one of the islands. Ensign Raymond G. Baldwin of Devon, Connecticut, got two of them with one bomb, dropped it right between their conning towers. Lieutenant Howard Boyston of Oklahoma got another one. And Lieutenant Rudy Kimitro, a former quarterback for Minnesota, got a near miss on the fourth one. It sank to the bottom, but the conning tower was still awash. So we called it probably sunk. After that, we flew on up until we sighted the Japanese mainland and then went home.
Well, how about fighter opposition, Bill?
Well, usually it was pretty weak, but we ran into plenty of it on the next raid over Formosa.
Well, that's where you got your five planes, wasn't it?
Yes, but I was only one. And the shooting was good that day. The Japs jumped us with at least two waves of 24 fighters each. And we knocked down 32 of them.
And you met them with how many planes?
14 that time.
14 against 48. And I think you said you didn't lose a single plane that day.
That's right.
That's the kind of squadron Bill Collins led from one end of the Pacific to the other. From Formosa, they went back down to the central Philippines to cover the invasion of Leyte, for which they had paved the way. I think they're entitled to a good rest and Christmas at home. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
A few minutes ago, word came from Moscow, an announcement by Premier Stalin, that the Russians have captured Miskolc, the last great center of German resistance in northeastern Hungary. Violence broke out in Athens this morning as left-wing Greek parties called demonstrations in defiance of a government order banning the proposed meetings. The CBS shortwave listening station here in New York heard a report by a British correspondent who watched from his window as police opened fire on the demonstrators who were protesting a government order that Greek guerrilla troops turn in their arms. At least a dozen persons, including women and children, are reported to have been killed or wounded. Once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
I wonder if you have any idea how short 4.5 seconds really is. Well, I'll show you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1/2. Short, isn't it? But that's just as long as it will take the new and improved Admiral automatic record changer to change records. That's faster than anyone dreamed possible a few years back. But Admiral engineers have the initiative and know-how to make this faster time a reality. Gone will be those long waits between numbers with your post-war Admiral changer. You'll hardly notice the break between the end of one selection and the beginning of the next. Admiral's new permanent type needle will please you, too. That tedious task of changing needles between records will be a thing of the past. The high fidelity of your post-war Admiral, America's smart set, will give you the most lifelike reproduction you've ever heard. Yes, for quick record-changing time, perfect reproduction, beauty of tone, and long life to your records. There'll be nothing to compare post-war with a changer built by Admiral Corporation, the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. Traffic accidents increased 10% during the first 6 months of 1944. Now that winter, with its additional driving hazards, is here, be extra careful when driving. Observe all speed and traffic regulations. Be sure your car is in safe operating condition and be ready to stop quickly in any emergency. Observe the ABCs of driving. Always be careful. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral dual-temp refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday
when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.